Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Politicians calling to regain control of the nation's borders suffer from a severe case of historical amnesia. So argues Peter Andreas of Brown University. He says illegal immigration and smuggling played a key role in the birth and development of the United States. His new book is titled Smuggler Nation: How Illicit Trade Made America. Peter Andreas joins me here in this studio. You are welcome to be part of the program. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Good morning to you.
I'm interested in what the story of smuggling tells us about ourselves as a country.
Nice, broad, open question for me to start off with. Basically, what I try to do in this book is to re-narrate the American epic through the lens of smuggling, which is sort of a new take on the centuries-long story, and basically it gives a new look at some old and familiar stories: the American Revolution, the American Civil War, westward expansion, slavery, the Progressive Era, into the debates and battles over globalization today, and so on. But if you look at it through the lens of smuggling, these familiar episodes, trends, and so on look a bit different. And so even from the very get-go, you see, if you scratch deep enough and look deeply enough, that smuggling, in fact, was essential to the very birth of the nation.
How so?
Well, if you look back at what was the most important economic activity of the New England colonies in the decades leading up to the American Revolution, the molasses trade from the Caribbean to New England distilleries for rum production produced the colony's most important export, which was rum, which was used in all sorts of ways, but including selling rum in West Africa to purchase slaves who were then brought to the Caribbean, and then more molasses brought to the colonies. Now, we know how much molasses is needed for those rum distilleries, and yet the legal imports on the books of molasses don't come remotely close to what was needed to keep those distilleries running. And so the gap is made up by smuggled molasses in violation of very strict British trade laws.
So from the very outset of the birth of our country, you believe smuggling was somehow helping to introduce an economy that was helping the country grow.
Exactly. I mean, what I just said, frankly, in some ways is provocative and controversial, but no one other than John Adams acknowledged what I just said. In fact, he famously wrote after the Revolution, quote, "I know not why we should blush to confess that molasses was an essential ingredient in American independence."
Interesting. You also say that smuggling helped George Washington win the war.
Absolutely. We always talk today about contemporary civil wars and revolutions and so on as somehow sustained by illicit economies of, you know, cocaine or opium or whatnot, but this trend goes back not just years but centuries, and we need to not look any further back than our own history of rebellion. And George Washington simply could not have taken on the world's leading military power without massive smuggling of gunpowder and other goods into the colonies, rebel colonies. Basically, his forces were utterly dependent on Dutch gunpowder and from other sources because the colonies had no real domestic production capacity. And so how does a ragtag force of rebels really not only take on but win over a British military superpower? The other thing that is part of the story is privateering, which is essentially legalized piracy, though the British considered it piracy, outright piracy, because this was an unlawful rebellion from their perspective. So they basically, New England merchants and merchants from other colonies were essentially given the right to attack British supply lines and keep part of the proceeds. And so this was a story as much about profit as it was about patriotism. And one of the messages from the book early on is the line between patriotism and profiteering is actually a blurry one. Today there's a debate over whether rebels are motivated by greed or grievance. And frankly, in our own story tells us that, frankly, both matter a great deal. We've had a lot of grievance, and we've also had enormous amount of greed. And one interesting thing I found out in the early history was this goes, it's a very familiar, intimate story. I teach at Brown University. It turns out that John Brown, one of the founders of the university, emerged from the American Revolution as one of the richest men in Rhode Island, partly from profiteering from the American Revolution. He did these what was called powder runs, going for smuggling in gunpowder and then charging George Washington exorbitant prices because George Washington had no choice but to accept that under the dire circumstances.
Peter Andreas, he's professor of political science at Brown University. His new book is titled Smuggler Nation. Do join us, 800-433-8850. What in the world got you started on this search regarding smuggling?
Well, it's an old story. I hate to admit that I'm getting up there in age at this point, but it really started right after college. Liberal arts education doesn't really prepare you for much in life other than to be prepared for sort of anything. So I took a four-month trip to South America, rather a bit of an adventure, specifically Peru, Colombia, and Bolivia. And while I was crossing the border by bus from Peru into Bolivia, a nice elderly lady, I was one of the only gringos on the bus, she handed me this huge package of toilet paper and pleaded with me to please put it under my seat.
Toilet paper.
Okay. Seems a pretty benign product, right? Which I treated as such, so I was trying to be nice, and I agreed with her. I put it under my seat, and the border guards came on at the crossing and proceeded to confiscate toilet paper from most everyone else on the bus, except my stash, because I didn't fit the profile, I guess, of the toilet paper smuggler. She was very grateful. Well, I found out later that Bolivia was experiencing a severe shortage of toilet paper, partly, not entirely, but partly because it was used as a filter, as a drying mechanism for coca paste production, which was part of cocaine processing. And so in my own small way, as a 22-year-old recent graduate, I contributed to the global cocaine trade.
But you really don't know if this sweet little old lady needed the toilet paper for its usual function or for cocaine.
That's true. And frankly, maybe she didn't know herself.
Yeah.
Right? She's just one of an ant in the supply chain, if you will. On the same trip, I actually caught a cargo boat on the Amazon traveling from Iquitos, Peru to Leticia, Colombia. And late at night, they not only brought on people like me trying to hitch a ride, but also barrels of chemicals in the cargo hull. And they disposed of these chemical containers shortly before arriving in Leticia. And again,
how did they dispose?
Well, they basically it was
dumped
on Amazon.
Them?
No, they didn't dump them, but they basically people came up to the boat and put them, ferried them to shore, if you will. And this is a region which, at the time and still today, is a cocaine processing area. And frankly, although the United States and other countries were obsessively focusing on stopping the cocaine coming north, mostly for U.S. consumers at the time, there's very little focus on the desperate need for chemicals from north to south to feed the cocaine processing plants. In other words, we almost had a free trade in the chemicals going south, but a very prohibitious policy, obviously, in the drugs coming north. And so I was, it was an eye-opening experience. So I ended up coming back to Washington. I was living here at the time and worked at various think tanks and on the Hill. And I wrote it up. I looked into it a little more, and a short piece in the New Republic came out, one of my first published articles. I think it was called Cocaine Chemistry, How We Help the Cartels Cook Their Coke, was the title that I didn't come up with. They have better title wordsmiths at the New Republic than I am. Then basically I got a call from the Hill. They were the congressional testimony on chemical diversion and trafficking. And so at the young age of 23 or 24, I was testifying alongside the DEA's main person on chemical diversion, a guy named Gene Haslick, but I think he's probably retired by now, on this issue. And chemical industry representatives sitting nervously in the audience because they were not looking forward to more regulations imposed on U.S. chemical exports to Colombia. At the time, Colombia was importing many, many, many times more chemicals than its legal industry could possibly absorb. So we knew that some of it had to be diverted to cocaine.
Peter Andreas, he's professor of political science at Brown University, author of a new book titled Smuggler Nation. Your calls, your emails, after a short break. Welcome back. Peter Andreas is with me. He's professor of political science at Brown University. He's written a fascinating book titled Smuggler Nation, all about how illicit trade made America. And indeed goes very far back in our own country's history, showing how we as early Americans were participating in that very activity. Talk about Alexander Hamilton's support of smuggling.
Sure. Well, the story there is about an adolescent new nation trying to catch up to England and other powers. And this included economically. And Alexander Hamilton was an outspoken advocate of acquiring British technologies by any means necessary. And so much so that if we, you know, apply this today to today's debate on intellectual property theft, there's a lot of finger pointing to other countries, especially China. But I would say the message of this book is the message from the U.S. to other countries today is do as I say, but not as I did. And by that, I mean the United States engaged massively in the sort of intellectual property theft that it now tells other countries not to do. This applies to patents, but also to copyright. So in the realm of patents, you know, British industrialists would, you know, patent their product in England. But then the technologies would somehow appear in the United States, smuggled in various means and forms, and they would not have those protections here in the United States. And importantly, not only did the U.S. economy need these technologies to jumpstart its industrial revolution, but it also needed the machinists, the artisans with the skills. And so the smuggling story not only applies to the equipment, but actually to enticing and wooing and encouraging British artisans with the skills to come to the United States illegally. These are in strict violation of British immigration laws. You could not leave the British Isles if you possess certain skills like this. And yet the United States encouraged massive violation of these laws. And the most famous violator was, of course, Samuel Slater. If you look him up, he's credited as the father of the American Industrial Revolution. He came to New York, and then Moses Brown, the other Brown brother discussed in the book, again, founder of Brown University, hired him to come up to Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and set up the first textile mill there. Sam Slater basically smuggled himself to the United States, tried to work on the equipment that had been smuggled to Rhode Island, but mostly ended up cannibalizing it for its parts. And the rest is a history. It's basically an illicit industrialization story, much celebrated in American high school textbooks, but not often described as also a story of theft and illicit acquisition.
So you take a look, for example, at what China is doing today, and what you're arguing is that is kind of a mirror image of what the United States was doing in its early growth and development, and you apply that to other countries around the world.
That's right. I mean, it's not history exactly repeating itself, but there are some very familiar echoes from the past. I think it was Mark Twain who basically said, "History does not repeat itself, but it rhymes." And Mark Twain, interestingly enough, is a part of this story of intellectual property protection, because Charles Dickens came to the United States in the 19th century and was outraged to find that his books had been widely copied without his authorization. He was getting no royalties from it whatsoever, never being asked permission to do this.
All over the place.
Exactly. The United States was a hotbed of intellectual piracy in the 19th century. And so, understandably, American film producers and other artists today are outraged when their product makes it to the black market in China and elsewhere almost immediately upon release. But again, echoes of history, it was Charles Dickens then, now it's, you know, Steven Spielberg. And Mark Twain, the reason I mention him is it was only after the United States started producing its own intellectual property that it generated a self-interest in becoming an advocate for protection. So Mark Twain ended up being on the same page, literally, as Dickens. They both wanted protections. And so the United States went from being the most extreme violator of intellectual property to being the world's champion of intellectual property protections, conveniently forgetting its own past.
So now in China, instead of literature or chemicals, you have Louis Vuitton bags, you've got Rolex watches.
Exactly. And funny you mentioned those two in particular. A crucial important change from past versus present is the importance of brand names. So Rolex, Louis Vuitton bags, and so on. That brand recognition is a distinctly contemporary modern economy phenomena. It was more, we could call it in the past, more industrial espionage, stealing secrets and so on, which still happens today. But the knockoff, you know, Levi's and so on is a more contemporary phenomenon.
Let's go back to people and immigration, illegal and otherwise, because here's an email from Mike, who says, yes, America was settled by immigrants, but those days are over. What happened in the past cannot justify the continued illegal expansion of our population. So the other aspect you get into in this book is people coming across our borders illegally.
Yes. Much of the book focuses on the illicit movement of goods, but there's also a substantial focus on the movement of people. And I would not want listeners or readers of the book to get the impression, which is a false impression, that somehow this is it's saying everything's fine. The past, since it's so much familiar today in the past, that it's okay to do today what we did. If you take that kind of argument to its grotesque extreme, we would start saying slavery is fine today because, well, it used to be fine then, and we were trafficking slaves, and so what's the problem with doing it today? That is obviously not the message of the book, but the book does say, look, there's nothing totally unique about the contemporary period which would make us had a kind of hyperbolic, alarmist sense of having to do something dramatic.
Because you argue that the U.S.-Mexican border has never been secure.
And if you look back far enough, you realize that today, without a doubt, that border is more secure, more policed, more patrolled, more monitored, and so on, than any other time in the country's history. Is it still a leaky border? Absolutely. But the whole history of that border is a leaky border. And in fact, history of the U.S.-Canada border, which we often forget about because all the attention is focused south, is a history of a leaky border. So much so that one could argue that U.S.-Canadian trade relations, which is so celebrated today, was founded on smuggling. U.S.-Mexico economic relations, so much of it was actually founded on smuggling. And the actually unauthorized movement of people story, which you want to focus on now, is somewhat of a latecomer to this story. But we should not forget that, and I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but basically the U.S.-Mexico War in mid-19th century was partly provoked by unauthorized U.S. migration to Mexico, into Mexican territory. Mexico's response, one could argue, is a failed militarized response to American westward migration. And it backfired, obviously, and Mexico is certainly not forgotten about it. The other interesting story in the book is that the first unauthorized migrants from Mexico that really concerned U.S. authorities were not, in fact, Mexican. They were Chinese. After the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 1880s, the front door for Chinese laborers to get in the country through San Francisco and elsewhere was shut, or largely shut. What did these laborers do? They didn't just stop coming. They were dispersed to other entry points, illicit entry points. So first trying to enter through Canada, and then increasingly through Mexico. And this is where the real migrant smuggling story begins. And ironically, back then, there was so little concern about the back and forth movement of Mexicans that U.S. border officials paid no attention to them. Ironically, one of the methods the Chinese used to try to sneak into the U.S. At official border points of entry was to pretend to be Mexican.
Wow.
Hard to believe today, right?
Hard to believe.
Exactly.
All right. Let's open the phones. Here's some of our callers' questions. 800-433-8850. First to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Crawford. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Good to talk to you again. It's
Thank
been a couple
you.
Of years.
Good to have you.
My comment and question for Peter is, I can't think of the gentleman's name, but I believe he was part of the original Jamestown movement, and one of the things he smuggled in were tobacco seeds, which were at the time, I believe, was controlled by the Spanish and very, very illegal. And the fact that him and a lot of the founding members of that Jamestown colony were able to cultivate tobacco and sell it at a huge premium to the British laid down a very good financial foundation for them and thus a lot of the country. But I think that whether you're talking about them or Al Capone and the many people that he employed, or just the whole underground economy, for lack of better terms, that's persistent in America since its inception, has played a very, very big role in the development of the overall economy. I mean, you were talking about the cocaine trade. Before it was illegal to deposit vast amounts of cash in the banks, that whole part of South Florida was essentially developed on the overabundance of cash that was in the banks. They were then able to write loans against to develop South Florida. So I think that it is really impossible to separate, all the good money from the bad. But any country or any business that's been able to develop itself or build itself in a short matter of time has been able to do it by being able to get a huge margin or a high margin on either its own commercial product or something that they essentially are getting for free via, via colonies or et cetera.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Peter.
Thanks for your comment. What's interesting I found in the book is that the illicit drug story, which you mentioned various times, is really a late chapter in this 300-year history. But if you think of drugs not just in terms of cocaine, marijuana, and heroin, and, for example, the South Florida story, which you mentioned, the heyday, late 70s, early 80s, in terms, especially, as you mentioned, the influx of cash into Miami banks. If you think of tobacco and alcohol, also as drugs, which we should, obviously, then the drug story is with us from the very get-go. And your story at the beginning of your comment about the smuggling of the tobacco seeds is right on target. Much of the smuggling story I tell focuses on the Northeast, but the tobacco boom in the U.S. Can very much be traced back to the theft of those seeds and smuggling them in into the colonies.
All right, to Waldorf, Maryland. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Yes. Professor Andrews, when you were introduced, one of the things that Diane talked about was that we have lost sight of the fact that we've had very porous borders, that the politicians that want to close the borders are agnostic to what's been going on. First, a comment. Number one, the Texicans that went into Texas and eventually took it away from Mexico were invited by the Mexican government to be there and to settle that area. But the point I want to make is that when the people that were being brought into this country earlier in our history, they were brought for a purpose. They were brought because they had a talent that we required. What we're dealing with now are people that don't even want to become citizens of the United States. They just want to take the jobs, send the money back home, and then when the working season is over, they go back home. So we're dealing with a different type of integration.
Well, it's certainly a provocative comment. First of all, I should clarify the historical record. You said that the Mexicans invited the Americans in, and the fact is they did it first. But then they tried to shut the door with the Mexican decree of, I think it was 1830 or 1832, where they literally said, "No, there shall be no more American immigration." And guess what? They kept coming. That sounds familiar, right? We used to invite the Mexicans. Then we tried to shut the door. We first invited the Chinese. They were welcomed in large numbers to help build the railroads. Then we said, "Oh, guess what? We don't want you anymore." But they kept coming. So that's a very familiar story. And so it's actually would be misleading to say, well, the Mexicans invited us in, because at one point they actually very much wanted to keep us out. Your story about somehow unauthorized migrants today are fundamentally different than the past, I frankly just have to disagree with that. There's something strikingly similar. And if you said they don't want citizenship, you're dead wrong. And there wouldn't be such a battle in Congress right now. I can assure you that last time there was an amnesty offered, millions of migrants signed up to become citizens, and that will happen again. And it's for all sorts of reasons, but frankly, you can also get better jobs once you're a citizen.
Do you believe that somehow we're doing the wrong thing in regard to immigration, considering our past history?
Well, one thing we're doing is, repeating some mistakes of the past. In this case, relatively recent past. I mean, the call in Congress right now is we must regain control of the border to secure the border as a prerequisite to doing everything else. And it's amazing. The history of the last 20 years is a history of unprecedented massive border policing escalation. In the 1990s, the size of the Border Patrol was doubled. It was doubled again in the last decade. The amount of money put into that is extraordinary.
Peter Andreas, his new book is titled Smuggler Nation. When we come back, more of your calls.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org, by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.
We've both grown tired of running after rain.
Rodney Crowell and Emmylou Harris have known each other for almost 40 years. He was in her band in the mid-70s, but they've just made their first full album as a duo. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with them and hear their music. Join us.
And as we return to our conversation with Peter Andreas about his book, Smuggler Nation, I think you've struck a chord with this book, Peter, from Luke in Caledonia, Michigan. Please talk about the illegal smuggling of Canadian liquor from Windsor to Detroit across the Detroit River during Prohibition.
Certainly glad you asked that question. We often forget, with all the excited, often anxious attention to the southern border, that the U.S.-Canada border at certain points in history was an equally busy hotbed of smuggling. And nowhere is this more illustrated than by the Detroit-Windsor crossing in the 1920s. This is literally a smuggling superhighway. In not so different than, say, El Paso Juarez is today. It was a main conduit of smuggling alcohol from Canada into the United States, with great fortunes made in that business, with the Canadian government basically turning a blind eye, not only turning a blind eye, but being complicit in the sense that they would allow the building of warehouses right on the Detroit rivers to facilitate the trade. They would stamp paperwork that said these little boats were going to places like Cuba and so on, to pretend these were legal exports of alcohol, even though it was obvious they were going just a few minutes away across the river. So this was, you know, basically this was the big border smuggling story of the 1920s, though there were obviously lots of places where alcohol was coming in.
So, Peter, what is your underlying message here? Is it that the U.S. is no better than any other country and no worse, but that all countries to a certain extent, and especially developing ones, and even after they're developed, participate in some form of smuggling?
That's a nice summary of what I'm trying to say in the book. It's not to focus disproportionately on the U.S. as somehow more engaged in this than other countries. But since the U.S. is the world's largest economy, biggest superpower, and so on, it plays a disproportionate role. It also plays a disproportionate role, and this we haven't discussed at all, in international anti-smuggling campaigns. So here's what's the underlying irony that I point out in the book.
Or is hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy is one way to describe it. The country that was born and grew up partly with the help of smuggling is now the world's leading anti-smuggling crime crusader.
Let's go to Wichita Falls, Texas. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Diane Rehm, Professor. Good segue into hypocrisy. I'm curious, since our nation is founded on smuggling, and, you know, now we are clamoring for anti-smuggling, does this raise credibility issues? Why should other countries or even our people take efforts, you know, whether it is to ban, you know, or stop smuggling of tobacco, firearms parts, pirated media? Why should we take these and other countries take efforts by America seriously? Because it seems to hurt our credibility, just like, say, it's hard to take China credible on human rights.
It's a good question and provocative question. I certainly, and I'm glad you asked it, because I would not want to give the impression that the message of the book is a kind of throw your hands up, libertarian response, open borders to everything and anything, because what we did well, we can now not expect other countries to do better. That would be the wrong reading of history. Again, the gross example, extreme example, would be slavery. Say, oh, well, we did slavery, therefore other countries, well, we should tolerate slavery. Frankly, one would like to think that the world has in some ways evolved in a positive direction. Some things that were tolerated at one point in time in history are not and should not be tolerated today. But it does not mean that at the same time that we should have this blind spot to our own complicity and hypocrisy in that. When we finger point to other countries, we should also finger point at ourselves.
And when we think about women as chattel early on in the history of this country, without a vote, without rights, without even parental rights, I think we have to look at other countries from our own perspective. Let's go to Baldwin, Missouri. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Diane. My comment is that we're still stealing, quote, intellectual property, unquote, of other nations. How are we doing this? We're allowing the best minds in the third world nations to come to America. We give them scholarships, of course, but if they end up staying, the majority of them end up staying here. And these minds are what the third world needs to lift it out of poverty and ignorance.
So-called selective immigration.
Yeah, I mean, it's an old debate in immigration literature, immigration policy circles, is the so-called brain drain, right? And some countries have actually made it a centerpiece of their immigration policy. Canada, for example, very much goes after migrants who are high-skilled migrants who can invest in the country and so on. The United States, because it's got probably the best university education system in the world, attracts people from all parts of the world to come and earn degrees, whether at the undergraduate or graduate level. And not surprisingly, many stay. And they stay for economic reasons, but often because they are people, not just workers. They stay because they got married or developed roots, social ties, and so on. It's hard to insist that people simply go back, kick them out, because it's not the best thing in the interest of their home country that they stay in the United States. So it's a very complicated issue. And in fact, in some cases, they do in fact go back and do quite well.
All right, to Groton, Connecticut. Good morning, Cameron.
Hey, everybody. I have a question regarding... I live in Groton. We have the oldest rum distillery, New London, over here. And I was wondering if sugar smuggling played a big part in the creation of the U.S. and through the trade triangle in the Atlantic. And afterwards, when the smuggling dies down, do these smugglers go on to smuggle other things, or do they try to reincorporate themselves into the economy?
Great question. New London, just an hour south of where I live, so you're almost in home territory there, and Connecticut is certainly a big player in that early history. When I told the story early on about the molasses trade, that's really a sugar story. In fact, they're violating the Sugar Act. And so sugar products in general are what's being, high restrictions, especially, for example, coming from the French West Indies rather than the British West Indies. So great competition between the British and the French, obviously, and that included in trade relations with the colonies. The British wanted to monopolize those trade relations given the situation at the time. The best part of your question from my perspective is, what do you do with these smugglers who basically grew up and became enriched through smuggling pre-Revolution America, and then suddenly told when the new nation is its own nation and independent, Washington is that now you shall obey the law. There's a kind of resocialization process at work here, which is difficult to pull off. And in fact, again, back to Alexander Hamilton, he realized that if he put too high a tax on trade, that there'd be massive violations, because this was the lesson of recent history, especially with the hyper-independent American merchants who really didn't want to pay attention to the rules. So there were a very modest 5% impost tax on trade coming into the country. And for the most part, it worked. But to enforce that, this is an interesting story about American government development, which is the federal government's utterly dependent on its own, revenue stream coming from taxing trade. There was no, federal income tax and so on until early part of the 20th century. So the federal government really lived on taxing trade. And so to the extent that the American government sort of grew early on and could be justified, it was to try to stop smuggling and raise a modest amount of revenue so it could just function in even a minimalist fashion. So you had merchants that basically grew up through smuggling, then told to be law-abiding citizens. It used to be patriotic to smuggle. After the American Revolution, the only kind of smuggling that remained patriotic probably was the intellectual property theft, the stealing of technology from Britain. Otherwise, it was considered a violation of U.S. law, obviously.
And now it's guns and drugs and everything imaginable.
You build it right up to the present. These are banned products rather than products that are evading taxes. So it's not as if the marijuana coming in from Mexico or cocaine and so on is costing the U.S. in terms of revenue. But it's interesting that one of the main arguments for marijuana decriminalization and legalization is statements about how much revenue the states and the federal government could raise, if it was legal.
Yeah.
Some of those numbers are probably a bit extreme, but it's interesting that those are the type of arguments that were actually used in trying to get alcohol prohibition lifted. Was look, we're broke. It was the depression. Look how much money we can raise by making alcohol legal again.
Thanks for your call, Cameron, to Biloxi, Mississippi. Hi there, John. You're on the air.
Thank you. Calling you from the great Smuggler's Cove of Biloxi, Mississippi, and where one of the mottos is, behind every fortune is a crime. And the incidents that he's talking about were not unique just to the East Coast. The same thing down here. But one of the points I wanted to make is it's not that smuggling has disappeared. Even when I was growing up in the 70s and the 80s, before Miami, the illicit drug trade was heavy here. And you would find the finest people of Biloxi that were engaged in doctors, lawyers, judges, sheriffs, and all that. Because a lot of people growing up, and I'd have to say I'm the same way now, growing up in the coastal areas, smuggling is often looked as a victimless crime. And, for example, now with Venezuela going down, I know people that are engaged and companies that are engaged in trying to buy some low-grade fuel there that you can burn on the ships and the tanks, and you can get for $1 a gallon, and you can sell for $2 or $3 a gallon, and you can get millions of gallons of that. And if you look at our most innovative companies, Microsoft and Apple, you know, their books and stories about how a lot of the technology that they were based upon, they have that they basically stole from other companies. So I think it's smuggling is, and that's kind of maybe part of the American way of life, or part of our dogma or something.
Smuggling as part of the American way of life is certainly an undercurrent, underscored piece of the story in my book. I couldn't agree with you more. There's not a lot about Mississippi in this book, but there's a lot about Louisiana, New Orleans in particular, and Florida, of course. And it's interesting that in the case of New Orleans, the famous pirates Lafitte were actually more smugglers than pirates. And in the War of 1812, General Jackson actually allied with them in defeating the British in their attempted invasion of New Orleans. So I probably don't cover the South as much as I should, but you're absolutely right that this is a tradition that extends to all coasts.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Old Forge, New York. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Diane, it's such a pleasure.
Thank you. Good to talk with you.
Oh, you know, one of the earlier callers talked about, I think he said something like earlier people came in because they had talent. I was wondering what talents the slaves had, you know. And, but moving on from that, you know, I've been thinking a lot at listening to your wonderful guests about the sex trade, you know, and you mentioned chattel and women, and of course it applies to young children. And that northern border up there between us and Canada, you know, I had a little job bringing kids to a summer camp. I had to cross that border a couple of times. And over the last couple of years, I was stopped at the border and questioned extensively, and I got that job done, but I asked a young woman that was a guard, you know, what was this all about? And she mentioned the sex trade, and she said that there are many, many cases, you know, numbers that are just unbelievable crossing that border with children, women. And I guess I'm going to ask your wonderful guest about, you know, the efforts that we're making to prohibit, say, Mexican workers to come in and provide economic benefit to the country, you know, the effort by the government to stop that. But, you know, looking at that effort to stop real slavery in this world, you know, what's the difference there?
Great question. And just to clarify, I didn't mean to imply that all early immigration was based on talent and high skills. That was specific to the early industrialization story, where they were basically British artisans violating British immigration laws. Certainly in the case of slave trafficking, the smuggling of Chinese laborers into the country, this was about bringing in
brawn,
labor, hyper exploitable labor into the country. And the slave story, which you're right to point to some contemporary comparisons, we do have to distinguish between slave-like conditions, slave-like trafficking, and the institution of slavery, where the state actually has the institution of slavery is legal. We had this peculiar situation in the United States for much of the 19th century, where the institution of slavery was legal in the South, but bringing more slaves in from abroad was prohibited. So we had peculiar dynamic where, you know, U.S. merchants and merchants from other countries were involved in trafficking illegally slaves into the United States, into the South, where slavery itself was legal. That is very difficult to crack down on slave trafficking when slavery is legal. And so the only way, the lesson here, the only way they were ultimately able to curb that was to prohibit slave, the institution of slavery itself, the demand side of the question, was what ended the slave trade.
And, of course, Mike is talking about the continued traffic in young women who've given up their way of life to come here and somehow earn a living for themselves. Peter Andreas, he's professor of political science at Brown University. His new book is titled Smuggler Nation. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rain.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from